Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The end of the Oklahoma legislative session is just a few weeks away, and as of today, the $1.3 billion shortfall looming over the entire legislative session for next year's state budget remains. My guest today wrote that whatever solution emerges to solve the state's billion-dollar budget problem, it will take some political courage, which is always in low supply in the Capitol in election years. That writer is Wayne Green, the editorial pages editor for the Tulsa World. He's my guest today. This past Sunday, he wrote about the possible solutions to fixing the budget hole and the likelihood of any of those solutions passing. As he described it, there are options. Some of the harder ones accomplish considerable good, and some of the easy ones create considerable harm. He joins us today to talk about the possible fixes for this year's state budget. Wayne Green, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Your most recent column outlined the various ways that the legislature can close this $1.3 billion shortfall in the Oklahoma state budget as we come to the end of the legislative session. It's only a few weeks away now. As usual in the legislature, it comes right down to the end where they'll hopefully find some sort of agreement. So you laid out a whole different number of ways in which they could close this shortfall. Obviously, they can't cut $1.3 billion out of the budget. So what ideas are likely to get the most traction through the legislature in your view?
You're right. There seems to be general agreement that you can't cut your way out of a $1.3 billion hole, which is a situation that they find themselves in.
There are a few members who would probably choose that path.
Perhaps. But the consensus seems to be that you can't provide essential state services and cut the budget by $1.3 billion. A state budget that in round figures is in between $6 and $7 billion a year. And when the problem is as large as they face, there's not going to be one solution. It's just going to take a couple of things. You know, the first thing that you start with probably is that they'll take some one-time money. They said at the beginning of the year that they weren't going to do that, but it seems hard to believe that they won't. Go after some money in the state rainy day fund. They could take up to $144.5 million for next year's budget, plus potentially another $96.3 million if the legislature were to declare an emergency out of a fund that has about $358 million in it. I think, frankly, they're unlikely to go for as much money as they can because they still don't know how bad next year might be. We had a report Tuesday that shows that the state general revenue fund taxes came in, I think, almost 13% short of the amount needed to make the budget for this year. That's pretty horrifying. We've had month after month after month of these really dreadful tax revenue numbers.
And, of course, you're seeing layoffs in the oil patch. Another one announced on Tuesday, an exploration unit closing operations here in Tulsa. It's going to be about 200 jobs.
So there's no
those are good-paying jobs.
Right. There's no reason to think we're at the bottom, I'm afraid. So they will probably, no doubt, be conservative with how much money they can take out of the rainy day fund. Yeah, there are also these sort of somewhat mysterious state cash funds that they'll be able to take some money out of. That seems to be good for between $200 and $400 million a year. These are fees and various things that are produced by state agencies that produce more money than they need to just to operate themselves. So that's that's a good starting point.
Well, that's a good point because $200 million, I've heard the figure more around about $125
million. Well, that may be more realistic.
Yeah.
And again, the same anxiety is there. If we take too much money this year, we need to be able to come back to that that fund next year too.
Now, let me ask you about one of the governor's proposals, which was a one-time sort of expenditure, and that was moving the capital spending on highways and bridges to bonds, mm-hmm. Sort of a one-time switchover from this off-the-top expenditure, which comes out before really the budget's available. And, you know, I've seen anywhere from $500 million to $700 million that you could say, but it's really a one-time cost, and it's also adding costs down in future years.
Exactly.
That seemed like for certain quarters it got a pretty good reaction. But from the legislature, everything I've heard is it's DOA, not a chance, at least that was the initial reaction.
Well, they didn't buy into it right away. as we get closer to the deadline, closer to adjournment, ideas that might not have seemed acceptable in February sometimes become more palatable in May. But, yeah, that's I would say that's still on the table just because there's a great potential for, as you say, for one time saving an enormous amount of money. the other side of that, as you say, is that we'll be paying for those bonds for 20 or 30 years, and every penny that we spend on bond interest and bond fees is a penny that we can't spend on roads and public safety and education. So, you know, there's definitely a cost to that. But with the hole as deep as it is and with the borrowing costs as low as they are, it would be hard to imagine that bonds don't become part of the formula at some point.
And let me ask you about that, because the infrastructure investment, that's an investment that actually comes back to the state in a lot of different ways. First of all, you have this highway investment, the roads are better, but also you're paying construction crews. You're basically adding people to the workforce who are, again, going to pay taxes. And that's going to sort of circle around a couple of times, hopefully.
And on a philosophical level, it's perfectly reasonable to say that future generations will enjoy the benefits of these new roads or improved roads. And so it's reasonable to expect future generations, the taxpayers, to help pay for them.
Yeah. I know your paper over the years has been a big proponent of infrastructure investment, highways and bridges. You've had countless series on the state of our highways and bridges. Is there a downside to taking this off-the-top money, which the state all agreed to when we decided to do this a few years ago, taking it back off the top of the budget and putting it into bonds?
Well, you know, when you make a decision in 2008 on how you're going to be spending your budget money for the next many years, there's always the potential for buyer's remorse there. You know, bridges and roads are a priority, but they're not the only priority. And if you decide that they get funded first, then you really have said that you've said that they're the top priority. And I think that my sense of taxpayers is that, in fact, education is the top priority. There have been efforts to fund education in a greater way with off-the-top money. We should say that there is already quite a bit of off-the-top money going to public schools.
True.
But there have been some efforts to create similar funds for education improvements, which really have not gotten any traction in the past couple of years.
Yeah. Now, one thing about Governor Fallon's Budget 2.0, the press conference she had the same day teachers were going to the state election board to file for office, was that this latest proposal said we're going to hold education harmless back to the beginning of this past year prior to the budget cuts that have occurred during this year. Any chance of that happening, do you think?
Sure. I mean, the chance, yes. It seems unlikely. Everything you hear coming out of Oklahoma City is that the legislature starts the budget base for agencies at, you know, how much the agencies were getting after the two general fund revenue failures. So that's essentially 7% below where they were or what they were promised for this year and what they never got. And certainly that's the way the school districts are acting. I mean, last night, three different school districts were cutting teachers and programs and making horrific choices, and Tulsa Public Schools has done the same thing previously. It's apparent that they don't have any faith that the legislature is going to come through with the sort of funding necessary to hold them harmless.
Now, one of the things that is getting traction finally at the state level is the exception of federal funds for Medicaid expansion through what's something they're calling the Medicaid Rebalancing Act, which will actually provide private insurance for the people affected by the Medicaid gap in the Affordable Care Act. And you're looking at, it's not a whole lot of revenue, although it brings a whole lot of revenue into the state just through the amount of fees coming in for paying for that care. But I think it saves the state, I think, $40 million a year, something like that in actual expenditures, is my understanding.
Well, yeah, the estimates coming from the state, for whatever reason, seem to be very conservative on the impact of accepting the available federal funds for rebalancing or expanding the health care coverage for people in Oklahoma. You know, when Arkansas made a very similar choice several years ago, the result was $1 billion went into their economy. And, you know, imagine what that does to an economy when, you know, it's all going into the service sector and into the insurance sector, but it's there. And one Arkansas legislator I spoke with told me that they saved $400 million because of their ability to accept this money. And that was enough money to underwrite a couple of tax cuts, including a lowering of their state sales tax on groceries, which, boy, wouldn't we all love to do that? They also saw their revenue increase because, you know, the economy was just larger. That,
you put $1 billion into a state economy, it's like it's going to multiply multiple times. It's you're paying a doctor. The doctor's paying his people. He's paying all these specialists. They're spending the money. That money goes around and around.
The state's estimates of the economic impact of the Rebalancing Act seem to be, I guess they should be, very conservative to me.
Yeah, and I think really it's things they will not actually have to spend money for that the Medicaid rebalancing will take care of. I mean, it's actual expenditures.
And of course, the most important thing of it is that we will have literally hundreds of thousands of uninsured Oklahomans with coverage. It prevents the teetering healthcare network in Oklahoma, especially in rural Oklahoma, from going down. It, you know, saves the vast majority of Oklahoma nursing homes that would be facing closing under the current scenario. You know, there's so many human need purposes that are served by this that it's hard to imagine that it's not just a no-brainer for the legislature, but it, you know, it's still controversial, and you know, I would say there's a 50-50 chance that it passes, and for it to succeed, or a key element of it succeeding would be a tobacco tax to come along with it, which, you know, there's very positive reasons for having a tobacco tax increase that have nothing to do with state revenue. It saves lives. It saves lives well into the future. That's you know, we all ought to be for it for that reason. But the revenue in this case is also essential to making the Rebalancing Act work.
That $1.50 a pack a cigarette tax raise would raise roughly around $180 million, I think, is the number I've seen. I'm going to get to another point of the whole thing about Medicaid and, of course, Nico Gomez coming out saying, you know, we're looking at a 20% cut, 25% cut in reimbursement rates. You had other people from the healthcare authorities talking about the effect on nursing homes. And from what I hear, phones lit up. In Oklahoma City. I'm wondering, given all the talk from educators about cuts, are the legislators seeing a similar reaction on education? Or are they inured to it because that seems to happen just about every year?
I think they don't feel the pressure right now. I mean, yesterday I was at a Chamber of Commerce luncheon. It was a state of education was the topic. And the three speakers were the superintendents of the Tulsa Public Schools, the Tulsa Technology Center, and Northeastern State University. And the thing they kept telling, the question they got more than once was, "What can we do?" And the answer was, "Just pick up the phone and call your legislator," because the way things work in Oklahoma City, three calls is remarkable. Five calls is a landslide, and 10 calls is cause to go make a floor speech. So, you know, the people sometimes are jaded about how important it is to communicate and communicate effectively. Don't do it through robocalls. Don't do it on a script. Just, you know, call your legislator, the person that represents your district. Let them know that you're a voter. Let them know that you're calling them about an issue that will, you know, make a difference in how you're going to vote in the future.
Yeah, you're watching his vote.
Right.
Yeah.
And that, her. You know, this one counts.
Yeah. My guest today is Wayne Green, the editorial page editor for the Tulsa World. He recently wrote on crunch time for the Oklahoma legislature as they're looking to fill a $1.3 billion shortfall. In his most recent Sunday column, he outlined a number of ways. We've talked about some of those. I want to talk about one that you didn't mention, which is increasing the fuel tax. I just took a long road trip across Oklahoma, and I had some wonderful roads and some really horrible roads. And when you think about it, Oklahoma has one of the lowest fuel taxes in the country, 17 cents. It hadn't been adjusted since 1987. I hear a 5-cent increase would raise roughly $135 million. Any traction on raising a fuel cut? Because you have truckers that actually plan the route to come through Oklahoma to get gas.
Right. And, you know, not only would it raise all that money, but a very substantial portion of that money would be paid by people who don't even live in Oklahoma, people passing through, which is, you know, the best tax you can have, but taxes paid by someone else. It makes a lot of sense. I've got no sense that it's getting anywhere in the legislature. The Oklahoma's fuel tax is low by design. As you said, it's designed to attract trucking companies and truckers to buy their gas while they're passing through the state.
It also takes a bigger toll on the roads because those truckers tear up roads.
That's right. You know, just sort of equalizing our fuel tax with the surrounding states would, at the very least, seem to make some sense. But there's also this. Prior to this, off the top funding that we spoke of for the Roads and Bridges Fund, the advocates for better roads put a question to the people about raising the fuel tax, and it went down in flames. That no poll counts more than the ones that we take inside the voting booth, and I think that is still the watermark on the issue of fuel taxes. Legislators think that the people don't want that. For whatever reasons, different states have different predilections toward taxes. And like it or hate it, and I don't particularly like it, but Oklahoma seems to be a sales tax state.
Yeah. Now, speaking of tax incentives and things like that, that what I'm hearing is that we're likely to see a rollback of a lot of the tax incentives. Now, what tax incentives is still up for debate, but I know wind is under a lot of pressure, and even from legislators, oil and gas incentives are under some pressure. But I hear the governor is, at least at this point, is standing fast against that. But there's one tax break. It's the unprofitable well subsidy. Mm-hmm. This is as I understand it, it's like if you pump less than 10 barrels a day. Right. You basically write off nearly all the tax on that 10 barrels. And now if you have a low producing well, you make sure every well doesn't go over 10 barrels a day. And I hear that just closing that would be $158 million.
Right. I can remember when they passed the stripper well tax incentive, it was designed for royalty owners because, marginal wells out in old fields still produced a little bit of income for people, and there was during a low price period, there was a movement towards closing in those wells, and once they're closed in, they're gone. And so to try to help some sort of people who were on the marginal end of the oil industry, they threw some incentives at it, and it seemed like a good idea at the time. But now, as you say, that's gone from costing the state $2 to $5 million a year to way over $150 million a year, and we're not in the business where we can afford that right now. Same thing goes with the wind incentives, perhaps only more so because in the case of the wind incentives, these could be terribly expensive over the years, and for a product that does not create the same sort of jobs that the oil industry does in the state, and for electricity that's not getting used here. It's almost all getting shipped out of state for companies that are not in Oklahoma. In fact, many of them aren't even in the United States. So there's a lot of reasons to think that might be one of the places where they can find some savings too. The tax issue that I'm watching most closely would be the possibility of them going after the earned income tax credit, which whenever they start talking about tax reforms in the legislature, a lot of times they go after incentives that would save literally tens of dollars. So they're just tiny little incentives, and then on page 15 of the 16-page bill, they throw in the earned income tax credit, which is a lot of money, but it's money that would come right out of the pockets of the poorest families in the state of Oklahoma. So there's a lot of rich people who are getting tax incentives in Oklahoma that seems like we could make some progress on those first.
Have you heard anything about the earned income tax credit showing up in a bill?
What I've heard, and this is second or third hand, is that there is a movement behind the scenes to go after the earned income tax credit, but that in fact the governor is standing firm on that one. So,
yeah.
If that's true, congratulations to
him. Yeah. Well, let's talk about a couple that don't – well, one that doesn't seem likely at all, another one that may or may not be likely. And the first one would be reversing some of the income tax cuts. We've had a series of income top income tax lowering of the rates. And I've always wondered why we don't stretch the brackets to give more everybody at least a little tax break instead of just lowering the top bracket. But that's another conversation. But to reverse the most recent income tax cut, which supposedly showed an increase in revenue to make that possible, you'd save about $150 million. That 2016 cut. And if we went back to where our income tax rates were during Brad Henry's administration, we wouldn't be having this conversation, chances are, or we having a slightly less conversation because we've cut that top rate quite a bit. But there seems to be no interest from either legislators or the governor in reversing that tax cut.
Well, 2 points. First, I think we would have a very big budget problem right now, even if we were at the 7% rate, because I mean, what happened was the bottom fell out of the economy, and the bottom was going to fall out whether you were taxing at 5% or you're taxing at 7%.
You're talking through energy.
Right. So, if no oil is being produced, no oil taxes are being paid. If no oil is being produced, roughnecks aren't working. Royalties aren't getting paid. So income taxes go down. If your income goes down, people buy less stuff. So sales taxes go down. So I think we were going to have this precipitous fall in state revenue associated with the price of oil being cut to a third of what it was at one point, now still less than half of what it was. I mean, I think that was that would have happened no matter what the tax rates were. Now, we would have been starting at a higher point, and we would have been ending at a higher point, and we probably would have had more money in the rainy day fund. So there's a lot of reasons to argue in this same scenario that cutting the tax rates was the wrong decision. It was the wrong choice. But we'd still be in a fix at any point. Now, as to whether or not we back out of even the last quarter point that went into effect on January 1st, I think that would be the last thing that the legislature, for good or ill, and I would say ill, that's just not a choice they're going to make. It is the thing that the three players, the House, the Senate, and the governor, they're all very proud of it. It's something that it's the foundation for their reelection campaigns. Those who aren't term limited, those who are term limited, they think of it as their legacy, the thing that they accomplished, the thing that they're proud of. And, they really do believe that if we can whittle down the state income tax rate, that the result will be long-term more prosperity. And, they'll tell you that every time we've done this, every time we've had a triggered tax cut, there's been an increase in revenue, not a decrease in revenue. Now they'd have to say every time we've done that, except one time. And then that one time was that. Of course, the trigger was – I'm sure you've gone over this before. And you meeting the trigger in the first place was a paper effect. It was not in reality. And so, there was an argument early in the session that the trigger was never well and truly made, and therefore we can, without having to go through the processes of a tax increase, we could call King's X on that one. But – I think that argument has been, if not refuted, has been ignored.
Yeah. One last thing, the double deduction on state income taxes, that saves about $87 million. That's been floated about for a long time, at least 4 or 5 sessions, and nothing ever happens. You think anything will happen on that front?
Well, it's possible. It would bring a lot of revenue in, and it's complex, so it's kind of hard to use against somebody in a reelection campaign, potentially. But let's call it what it is. That's a middle class tax increase.
Certainly upper middle class and for the upper incomes too, because they're the most likely to itemize.
If you itemize, it would be a tax increase for you. Yeah. Perhaps fewer people, because interest rates are so low, fewer people may be declaring their mortgage interest, and there might be a smaller percentage of people who are itemizing. But a lot of people would feel that. A lot of voters would feel it and would recognize it for what it is. It's a sad state of affairs, but it's a lot easier for a legislator to vote for ending the earned income tax credit because the beneficiaries are just don't vote. They're invisible to legislators. It's the same reason that it's so hard to get mass transit taken care of on a local level, because you're taking care of a constituency that doesn't take care of the politicians.
Yeah. We've kind of gone through some of the revenue increasing measures. The other one is to cut expenditures. Now, they can't cut $1.3 billion, but there will be cuts probably in a lot of budgets this year. I know we're seeing things like the Oklahoma Scenic Rivers go to the Grand River Dam Authority. There's a proposal to do that. And a lot of agencies. Are there any agencies that are really on the chopping block at this point? Because there have been a lot of cuts over the last few years.
Right. Yes. I would think that corrections is probably the one area where you won't see substantial cuts, because I think everyone now accepts that when they're at 122% of capacity and you know their staffing levels are just horrible, that there's just not much more to cut there. I hate to say it, but I'm afraid that higher education would probably be there seems to be a lot of noise coming out of the legislature about fat cats in higher education. This is a phrase that was someone used in a press release the other day. These things are all relative, but it's a relatively easy place to cut, because higher education has a fallback revenue source, which is they can raise tuition. It's not good for the state's future. It's not good policy, but I suspect there's going to be some cuts to higher education that would result in a substantial tuition increase.
Now, the legislature has to come to agreement by the end of the month, basically, and I'm hearing some talk that they may not have an agreement by the end of the month, and there'll be a special session in June. Are you hearing anything like that?
It's always possible. You know, technically, they're in a special session at the moment. The governor called a special session at the beginning, concurrently with the regular session, which you don't want to get into it, but it allows them to get around some legislative rules if they ever needed to, which I don't believe they've done this year. I'd bet against a special session. First of all, legislators are tired of each other. They're all, or three quarters of them, are all running for reelection. They don't want to. They don't want that. I suspect that, you know, like most years, the negotiations are going on somewhere behind closed doors on the fourth floor of the Capitol. They know all the numbers now. That they know all the scenarios. They're running ideas through their caucuses to see what they think they can get passed. I suspect the governor is holding fairly firm on some of her ideas, and that the other two negotiators, the House and the Senate, have some no compromise positions too. But past experience would suggest that they'll come up with a balanced budget this month, and then go run for reelection.
You can read all about it in the Tulsa World. Wayne Green, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Rich. I appreciate you inviting me on your show.
Wayne Green is the Tulsa World Editorial Pages editor. You can read his column every Sunday in the Tulsa World, as well as at their website, tulsaworld.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.